Welcome to Baird's IPO Reboot Series, where executives can learn the ABCs of going public. I'm Tom Shadold, a director on Baird's Equity Capital Markets Desk based here in beautiful Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In today's episode number 7, we'll be talking about IPO offering considerations. And I'm happy to be joined today by Mike Liddell from Solberry Capital. Mike, I'll pass it over to you if you wouldn't mind giving our viewers a quick overview of your background and focus.
Hey, good morning, Tom. So my name is Mike Liddell. I'm a managing director at Solberry Capital. I've been here for about 11 years. I joined following a early part of my career in equity research at Goldman Sachs, and then worked at Millennium Partners before joining Solberry back in 2012. Since joining Solberry, I've been fortunate enough to work on about 75 successfully priced IPOs, over 100 follow-on and block transactions, about a dozen or so companies that have been sold in parallel to an IPO process. And there's about 60 some odd companies in backlog looking for various sources of offerings, be it an IPO or follow-ons or blocks. And I'm one of six managing directors at the company, all of which have similar backgrounds coming from the banks and large capital markets desks. And we have, as a firm, about 160, 170 IPOs in backlog and a couple of hundred follow-ons, all from previously produced IPO mandates.
Yeah, Mike, maybe just a little bit on Solberry Capital, too, to anyone who may not be familiar who's watching the presentation.
Yeah, it's a good question. So Solberry is a firm that was founded back in 2005. And it was designed to help with the structural conflict that exists when issuing equity, where a bank, even great banks such as Baird, they represent two clients when it comes to a transaction, both the issuer as well as the purchaser of securities in either an IPO, a follow-on, or a block trade. And so Solberry was designed to help to pick a side and just to represent the issuer and to work with them through the IPO process, everything from the early stages of could you and should you do this, to then how to think about hiring banks, how to pay banks, how to structure a syndicate, how to work with research analysts, how to ultimately run a process, because in reality, everything in this world is a dual track, and then advise on the execution of an offering. From our position in the market, we're fortunate enough over the 17, 18 year history of the firm to now advise on about a third of all US IPOs, as well as about 50% of block trades and about 30-40% of all marketed follow-ons. So it gives a real catbird seat into what's going on into the market. And again, at our core, we advise just the issuer in a transaction. So advising our issuer clients on everything that's happening with an advantage of not having to have two clients in the mix. That's Solberry Capital at a glance.
Yeah, and I think that's a great segue into today's topic around offering considerations. And so usually kind of when you start thinking about the IPO process or as part of kind of your RFP process to hire a selection of banks, we kind of think about this offering term sheet. Maybe a good kind of starting place, a level set, Mike, is if you kind of lay out what those key line items that companies should think about when it comes to the offering itself.
Yeah, I think the first thing is for the overall size of an offering, it's, you know, at the end of the day, an IPO is it's a capital raising transaction, just like any other financing. And so we always think about what's right for the balance sheet. So that's always the first step. And so looking at saying, where does leverage need to be? How much capital does the company need to be fully funded to execute its business plan? And those should really be questions number 1 and 2, and they should be equally weighted. So get the capital structure right. And then from there, we look at some of the traditional measures of what size should an IPO be. And what we'll find is, if you look back historically over normalized windows, so if you exclude the most recent bull market, you would look at and see, well, companies generally sell about 15-ish percent of the company, sometimes as high as 20, sometimes as low as the low teens, but you can use 15 as a good ballpark to think about. And so if the capital needs of the business don't get you to a point that you're pushing up around that 15% of the offering, then you look to say, are there things we can do with the capital structure prior to an IPO, such as a dividend recap, where we could be selling synthetic secondary in the IPO, or are there existing pre-IPO shareholders who are looking to find liquidity, and are they willing to contribute their shares to an IPO if we need to increase the size? So that's how you get to a minimum size. And then you look at the other end of what's too big. And I think what we'll find is for companies that have, you know, higher leverage profiles than are typical for the IPO for the public markets, which, you know, usually, you know, revolves around, you know, an estimation of being at or below 4x at IPO. We think that's probably at the aggressive end. You probably want to be a little bit even inside of that in today's market. But if getting below that level requires you to sell, you know, in excess of 30, 35% of the company, sometimes those get to be IPOs that may be a little bit too big, a little bit too much of a full recapitalization that can make them more difficult. So short answer, we generally think about trying to find a good path to having about 15% of the company spoken for in the IPO. And then there's plus or minuses that go along with that if we need to toggle.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I think some people approach it almost overly formulaic. So I think how you kind of structured that just from a logic kind of process standpoint, we'll start with what do you need? What are you trying to accomplish? And then start building the offering around those company considerations first, and then make sure that they're within the realm of doability, right?
Yeah, I think the logic is the important part. I think where a lot of people can get sideways or get these early considerations wrong is looking at just layers and layers of precedents and saying, well, this is the precedent. This is what they did. This, therefore, I should go do that. And I think in reality, it all comes down to what's right for the company. And I think that same philosophy about structuring your offering about what's right is the same thing that goes way downstream, and you get to things about thinking about guidance policies and forecasts and valuation and all those different things. They all should come back to this point of what's right as opposed to what have others done.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think maybe, I know we talked about offering size a little bit, but you hear terms like primary and secondary and consideration mix thrown around. Maybe touch on that topic and kind of how companies should approach the ultimate mix versus primary and secondary.
Yeah, I mean, for an IPO, you know, one of the hard things to grapple with is it should be the most difficult and most expensive stock that an issuer will ever sell, which can make the idea of selling secondary shares really difficult. So let's define, before we hop into the 201 levels of primary and secondary, let's define what those are. So primary shares are it's capital raised by the company going onto the balance sheet. Secondary shares are shares that are sold from a pre-IPO shareholder into the public market. And in a practical, you know, way of looking at it, primary shares create dilution. Secondary shares are permanently sold. And often the counsel we'll give to clients is that because this is ideally the most expensive stock, meaning sold at the cheapest valuation, that if you believe in the company, which all issuers by definition have to do, you should logically want to constrain an offering to be mostly, if not all primary, because you can always earn back dilution. Right. If you take a 15 to 20% dilution mark at the IPO, but then the shares trade up in excess of that amount, you start to get back to an economic level that makes you whole. And you're just riding alongside like a pre-IPO shareholder always has, which is betting on the company. So primary shares are for sure an easier way to start the path down the public markets. But in situations, back to what's right for the company, if there's no need for capital and if the company should be public for a whole host of reasons, then the answer is secondary shares. And that's, and so you will see all secondary IPOs, and though it doesn't make them any better or worse than all primary IPOs, it's just what's back to this core question of what's right for the company.
Yeah, that's a great point too. And it's also being able to articulate that kind of on your IPO roadshow for the primary capital raising, right? What's the use of proceeds? That's going to be kind of a question you're going to have to field from investors. And if it is all secondary, then you kind of need to be ready for that answer of why are you going public to your point? And why is this kind of that must own story? And why does the secondary make the most sense? So I'd also frame it in addition to kind of the points you made from the corporate perspective, also kind of how you're going to approach marketing that too, as you kind of think about putting that mix together.
Yeah, I mean, if you're asking someone for money on a roadshow, the logical question you should expect is, what do you do this for? And if you can't articulate a good reason for, right, and this all comes down to the positioning of the business. If, right, you use capital for one of four reasons, either to repay debt, invest in the business, you know, prosecute an M&A regime, or return capital to shareholders, right? And so you need to think through that lens of what do we have a proven track record of operating our business, driving growth and driving logical capital allocation decisions against that matrix. And the answers to those questions drive you to what are you going to do with this capital if we give it to you? And you got to be ready to answer that question. If not, right, for all secondary shares, well, it also matters who's selling. Right. If it's great a difference point. Between, you know, between professional investors versus professional management teams, investors obviously take different views about the composition of the selling shareholder group when they are secondary components.
Yeah, that's a great point. The composition really does matter on secondary component for sure. Maybe shifting topics a little bit. I think you're well suited to answer this, given you sit in the IPO advisor seat and aren't one of the banks that's going to be involved as an underwriter on a deal. But how should companies think about building out their syndicate of investment banks who are going to act as the underwriters?
Yeah. So I think as we think about it, there's three skill sets that matter. You know, there's the banking, right, which is the positioning of the business, the equity capital markets team, and the research. And then there's always relationship. And as we think about when we first start advising clients, we encourage them to put blinders on to the relationship aspect and say, okay, what's right for the company? I think you're going to hear probably every answer we talk about. And as we think about all questions, we could go on for hours. You're always going to hear us go back to what's right for the company. And so as we think about putting together the syndicate, it's what's right for the company along the decision matrix of those three skill sets of banking, capital markets, and research. And so if we think about a syndicate of 8 to 10 banks in a syndicate, well, you're not going to see 8 to 10 of the greatest bankers. You're not going to see 8 to 10 of the greatest capital markets teams, nor are you going to see 1 through 8 or 1 through 10 of the top research analysts. We think about a mix, and it really is putting together a team. We do talk about IPOs being true team sports. And so as we think about balancing it, we do think that the most, you know, it's really important to do, right? If you're going to do an equity financing, the positioning of the business and the equity capital market skill sets are incredibly important, as is research, right? And so, but the first thing we often think about is encouraging a client to think about who are the one or two bankers who they actually trust to think about the positioning of their business. Who would they allow to hold the proverbial pen and write sentences and shape paragraphs and create pages to portray the historic success and the forward growth profile of that business? And often when you start and ask an issue or that question, the list gets awfully small, awfully quick. And you say, okay, well, who are the few folks who you actually trust to do this, as opposed to who gives you advice? Then the second is, well, of those small group of banks, do they have, you know, seasoned capabilities and frequency when it comes to the equity capital markets? Sometimes the answer to that is yes. Sometimes the answer to that is no. And we think about adjusting our team accordingly. And this is how you can get to situations where instead of having a lead left, where you can have multiple equal active book runners. Often we think about having two in that situation. And right, and that gives you a plurality of voices when it comes to the one or two bankers you trust. It gives you a plurality when it comes to having good equity capital markets advice. And then equally among that, I bring it up third, but it's not third most important, is thinking about research. Ideally, amongst those one or two banks in your top, you have a research analyst who has is able to grab the attention of the investor clients who will ultimately be purchasing the shares. And when we say grab the attention, we mean through relevance, right? I think it's important to have a research analyst, at a senior level of your franchise or of your syndicate, that when they make the phone calls to educate investors, they are a known commodity amongst the investor base. They're known, they're respected, they're viewed as independent. And so we think that's really important. So as we think about the top line, we start with those three considerations. It's very rare that we find a perfect athlete. It's very rare that there's a bank that has all three of those skill sets at the absolute best. And IPOs are in capital markets transactions, right? You think about the entire ECM landscape of IPO to then multiple follow-ons, a lot of things can change, even within the uniqueness and the superiority of one single bank. So we often think about putting a few together to give you some durability to go over time. And then as we, I started out this answer by thinking about putting a blinder on relationships. As we think about moving down the ranks in the syndicate, as economics start to move out, we do open the lens to two things. One, widening out that portfolio of banks who are able to join the syndicate and also bring really good, strong research capabilities. And also there's always room to think about the relationships that need to be rewarded for, alongside the IPO. So we think about those things when balancing the three skill sets. But at the end of the day, there's really no magic formula to how this all comes together. Each, back to, how I started this answer, it's what's right for the company. And thinking through what is right and how to put those things together through the mix of personalities, through the mix of possibly conflicting transactions that prevent one bank from working with you. And then, right, just overall, who gels with who. And that's how we think about what's right to move from the process. And the other complicating layer I put on this is time. I think often when issuers think about this, this topic, it can become overwhelming and it becomes, I need to make all these decisions today. And reality is you can defer and separate the decisions. So if you think about the early part of a process, which is really defined by working through the legal and SEC angles, that can be done with a very small group. So possibly just the senior active book runners. And then as you get closer to the execution phase, you can defer and then decide to bring in and broaden out the syndicate. So again, there's a whole bunch of different tactics and strategies that can be deployed here, but at its simplest level, it's putting together a team around this three skill sets of banking, capital markets, and research.
No, that's great, Mike. I won't comment on that one to leave it unbiased as it is, given I work at an underwriting bank. So maybe moving on, a lot of times you hear about this and it comes up in the news too around IPO lockup. Maybe just talk about the lockup. What's the market standard? I know sometimes you hear kind of structures in the market that are more bespoke. Maybe just kind of talk about the IPO lockup question and what issuers should be thinking about there.
Yeah. So in basic form, a lockup is a 180-day contract that an issuer has with the lead underwriting banks that prevents named executive officers, so the slang for that is NEOs, directors, insiders, and really all other affiliates. So basically folks with material non-public information or access to it, they're restricted from selling for a 180-day period. And that's a contract that's held by the lead underwriting banks. And in principle, what it's designed to do is to make the IPO the only place where a potential investor can buy shares, right? So it creates a call to action, it creates a sense of urgency, but it also creates limited subsequent supply so that the shares in their early days can find good, normal, just market making where buyers and sellers are matched and you can find and the shares can settle out into a good average daily trading profile, average daily trading volume profile, which allows for normalcy, right? And so if you can prevent more shares from coming on, that obviously helps that. Shareholders who are not captured within 180 are often employees. Now, while they are not technically subject to the lockup, I think most will be governed by insider trading policies, blackout windows of the company. And of course, we are not lawyers and we would not count on this advice as legal advice. So we encourage anyone who is watching this as an employee of a newly public company, check with your internal resources for guidance on what to do here. Whether you are or not subject by a lockup. Now, to the actual technical question about what to think about other things with a lockup and how to think about what to do with them, a good number of our clients actually break their 180-day lockup. And they break their 180-day lockup because of price performance of the shares, where the shares trade up in a way that in a good and orderly way. And the issuer is able to go to the banks and ask to be released from the lockup and to come out and do a marketed follow-on offering because investors are clearly looking to buy more. Now that is it's the exception, not the rule, that you can do that. And I think it takes a fair amount of judgment to know whether the shares are in a good condition to come out and do that type of offering. But it's one of those things that you know it when you see it. And when you do it enough times, you're able to see if the market can handle it. And by and large, usually these offerings are well received and they trade well going into the offering and they trade well coming out of the subsequent offering. What we saw during the last couple of years is there were some mechanisms that were put into place that were either, instead of being time-based, they were dictated by share price performance hurdles. And I think as you look at what was going on in the time, it was such a euphoric market that you could largely do what you wanted to do. But if we think about going back to what's right for the company, right? If you think about a newly public company that has a 180-day lockup, when you come and break that lockup, you're surprising the market. And right, you're announcing an offering that's otherwise maybe desired but not anticipated. And that's where judgment comes in. What I don't think we think makes a lot of sense is some of these things that would put in price-based mechanisms for release. So for instance, if the shares traded up 30 or 40 or 50%, then X portion would be released from lockup. And then if they traded up even further from that, they'd be released again. And we think that when you introduce those types of clear metrics, you remove some of the elements of surprise, and that can introduce caps on price performance or things like that that are otherwise detract from the idea of having an orderly market of trading every day, because folks are able to anticipate when more shares are going to come. So I think at its core, it's been 180 days for a very long time. We think we're very comfortable in that structure because it allows, again, order in a market, and then for issuers that have found success with their share prices coming out of their IPO transaction, there's a tried and true logical path that brings you to a point where you can break lockup and go and do a follow-on offering earlier than that 180-day threshold, provided that the company is putting up good performance. Usually it requires the company to at least report one quarter. Right. And often, be public for 90 to 100 days. And then you can think about, utilizing some of these tools and tactics.
Maybe shifting to the timing topic, it's kind of a concept you start hearing when you're talking about kind of the blackout periods or just public companies in general. But there's this concept of IPO windows and you need to be ready to kind of hit them. Maybe you can touch on kind of when those windows fall each year during the year. Are there any betters or others tactically about when to decide to launch? And maybe I'd like to leave everyone some practical advice. about the market today and kind of how they can think about it if they're going down this path, but maybe give an example of how the timing works if you're trying to hit a first quarter IPO kind of next year.
Yeah, so, well, in any given year, right, there's 52 weeks in a year. And, you know, the reality is we can all do a lot of things any week of the year in our personal lives and most of our professional lives. When it comes to an IPO, not all 52 weeks are good for an IPO. And so you start getting into this concept of windows. And, you know, at their core, the windows are defined by a couple of things. It's market holidays, financial staleness, corporate blackouts, traditional vacations, right? When are people generally out of school on holiday with their kids? And then obviously macro events such as Fed meetings and for next year, the election, right? These are all big things that define investor risk behavior as well as issuers' capability to go to market, right? So you put those two things together and out of that start to fall pretty clearly defined IPO windows. You know, as we use those as filtering lenses, as you look across a year, you'll see that as you layer all those things onto a calendar, the vast majority of the quote IPO windows reside in the spring and summer months. And then there are periods in the fall and in the winter that allow for very opportunistic paths to the IPO market. For all issuers, right? The reality is that it's very difficult to say, we're going to look forward today and we are going to launch on April 17th of next year, right? There's so many variables that go into that, right? Of all that need to turn up green in order to hit that first thing. So as we start the conversation on windows with clients, we look about how do you maximize your yield against multiple windows as opposed to having a pinpoint need to do it. So as you back up, you say, okay, well, as you sit here today, and if you were to say, well, I want to be ready to go for the back half of next year. Well, the first part of that conversation says, well, great, let's do that. But we need to look and say, okay, in reality, there's a presidential election happening. Presidential elections don't mean you can't do an IPO. It's just an added degree of risk. And so, and some issuers have the tolerance for that and some do not. And so you look at that and you say, okay, well, if that is an unacceptable risk, what can we accelerate or should we look at not trying to be ready to go there and have our base plan actually to go after the election, right? So you look at, you start at those conversations and I think it's important to be ready to hop, skip and jump through different windows and be ready to move. But you always start with what's the earliest point where you could be ready. And as we think about this, you know, a saying we have is luck favors the prepared, right? And so how do you align, that kind of saying with the strategy of the issuer to be prepared so that we can move forward and take advantage of opportunistic markets? You know, ultimately a deciding factor for if an issuer should, you know, choose a window is, you know, it comes down to two fundamental words that we think are really important, could and should, right? Just because you are ready and you could do an offering doesn't mean you should, right? But if you invert that, you know, you can't logically have a conversation about should you launch, you know, in the back half of next year unless you've done a whole lot of work in advance of that and could you actually do that? You know, I think to your last question about, you know, being ready for a specific window, if an issuer wanted to be ready for the Q1 window of next year, that's largely defined by 2 months. There's a brief window in January and there's a brief window in March. Each have elements of risk associated with it. So to be ready for that January window, an issuer would need to be in a position to file with the SEC at some point in the mid to late September period, and probably as late as early October. You can always do a shorter SEC process if you want to make compromise decisions, but we never advocate our clients to take compromise decisions. So if you want to be ready in January, you probably want to be in a position to file in some point in September, which, you know, Tom, we're recording this, it's what, July 18th. That for an issuer who wants to be ready for then, you'd want to be doing some pretty serious work on the preparation phases today to be in a position to file. And you'd probably want to be hiring, you know, banks in the very, very near future. I mentioned, right, some pros and cons of January and March. So in January, you know, the keys to the kingdom, which would allow an issuer to go in January, is having the ability to put out recent developments in flash numbers. That can be difficult and daunting for some issuers. If that's not something that's solvable, or if filing in September isn't solvable, but filing in late October is, then you would want to look at March and say, well, not only do I need to be able to file in by the, let's call it the October period, but I also need to have my audit done, my annual audit done under a PCAOB standard, realistically by the middle of February. And for a lot of issuers, that can be really difficult to do without early planning and a lot of resources thrown at it. So, you know, we could go on about every window throughout the rest of the year, and every window has an element of risk to it. And I think it, for issuers who are looking to go public, that, you know, this can be a really overwhelming part of the conversation. And I think it's good to look back at all others who've made it through, you know, the IPO gauntlet, and realizing just how hard it is once you get closer to it and realize how limited and how compromised some of the decisions have to be made when they go into a could versus should type conversation about launching.
Yeah, absolutely. You should always kind of have a target, but make sure to be nimble and opportunistic and ultimately kind of realistic about whether it's a target that can be achieved. And ultimately, you'll kind of need to be flexible, because the other input outside of some of the variables we're talking about specifically this answer, just the market in general too, needs to be cooperating in whatever window you happen to be ready in. So,
yeah, I think with that, right, it's important to think about the organization and the shareholders and the stakeholders. So as we advise clients, it's important for, you know, the management teams to advise up to their boards about what timelines actually look like and how things can move around, and just the realities of how specific some of these windows are. And then there's also an element about thinking about all the stakeholders inside of an organization. Because at the end of the day, every IPO is a massive branding opportunity for the issuer. And so thinking about all the internal stakeholders and how do you want to message and manage their expectations. Obviously, there's a whole probably other section of these conversations you're having with folks about the legal risks and the responsibilities that go with internal communications and things along those lines. But it's important to think about managing those and making sure that it doesn't become a distraction to the organization as IPO windows inevitably drift from one to the other.
Absolutely. And so maybe, I know we could talk about a lot of these topics all day long here, Mike, but maybe we'll move on to the kind of final topic I like to ask people at the end of each episode. And response doesn't need to be limited to what we're just talking about today, but what are the three most important pieces of advice that you would give a company that's thinking about going public?
Well, I think there's a softball in there, right? Which is obviously, you know, find Solbury, hire Solbury, right? So let's just be shameless and put that out there. In the answers to some of the questions you were asking me, yeah, I think there was a theme I was kept coming back to, which is one, do what's right, but more importantly, these two words of could and should. And I think that often issuers think about, you know, should I go public in this window versus that window? And you know, the assumption that's made is that you could actually go public. And I think the advice that we often give clients at the early stages is to invest heavily in their counsel. There are all sorts of things in the world where you can either spend more or less on, but I think having a good legal foundation provides the flexibility to move from window to window to quickly respond to the SEC. And so I think it's we're pretty big fans of having good experienced counsel who can guide you through a process, because these things can be daunting, and you want to have folks who are really experienced. There's all sorts of good lawyers out there, Similar to bankers, bring on someone you trust and know, but again, frequency and, making sure that they're there by your side is we think that's good advice. And the other is be yourself, right? To think about, the positioning of a company, there are lots of great bankers in this world who can help with positioning, and we should let them help with positioning. But to hand over the keys to the car or to let someone reposition your business away from what you actually are and how you actually interact with your customers and employees and everyone through your stakeholder food chain, I think it's really important to be true to yourself, because at the end of the day, this is something that's going to have to remain true for not only the quarters, but hopefully the years and decades to come. And starting out with the right positioning, with the right placement in the world, we think is really important. And just resist the temptation to be for the siren song or whatever the fads are, on what words to use or stretching on your projections to drive valuation. Obviously, valuation is a very important topic, but if you think about it's the first of many transactions to come. Playing the long ball and trusting that over time the market's going to be efficient and award structurally well positioned companies and well operated companies from good management teams, it's all going to work out. So I think it's a hire Solberry, pay for good counsel, and be true to yourself.
So I think we'll end it there with that sage wisdom. I'd like to thank Mike and our viewers for their time today. I think they'll find a lot of your insights highly valuable as they embark on their own IPO process. If you'd like to get a hold of either Mike or I, you can find our contact information on our respective companies' websites. And thanks again to our viewers, and thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.